actually falls in line what's being discussed in a direct or sometimes indirect way. So, a little bit of background, and I know we're starting late. I guess I got about an hour or so we'll see. And incidentally, there is some static on the repeater, and I'm listening to myself. So, I got to make sure I don't time it out, because the timer is set for 3 minutes. So, this week we're going to continue our discussion of impedance matching, and specifically matching with transmission lines. Now, getting into transmission lines is a whole new subject of how to match, and there's a lot to it. So let me let it drop. Initially, and by the way, Ed, I'm happy that you're listening. You can always throw in a word or two. I'm listening to the static also. I guess you guys hear it. You're listening, you know, putting in a word or two with that. I was going to continue the discussion right from QST, and this is November. Last week we were talking about different ways of matching impedances other than using transmission lines. This was using transformers, iron core transformers, RC, resistive capacitive networks, semiconductors like operational amplifiers to change impedances, and emitter follower circuits, which is a transistor circuit, you know, so on and so forth. But this particular month, and it's by Ward Silver, N0AX, he discusses impedance matching with transmission lines. And it's in November 2019, QST. So I thought about this and I said, well, before we get into a discussion of matching with transmission lines, and that would be, he prefers the coax cable, refers to coax cable, basically, but most people don't even know what a coax cable line is, electrically. You know, most people think, oh, you got a piece of coax, and everybody knows, if you've dealt with antennas, that it's a center conductor with a shield around it, separated by a dielectric, and that's a coaxial cable. And that's one type of transmission line. There are others too, which I'll mention. But there's a lot more to it. Electrically, there's more to it, and you really have to understand what goes on electrically to get a better understanding of how to use that to match. Right? Makes sense? So, I decided, let me let it drop. Way back in the 70s, I inquired a course, a complete communications course by National Radio Institute, and divided into bite-sized sections and dealing with anyone who wanted to learn about communication systems and obtain their FCC license. And there were many courses that you could, if you looked in Popular Electronics Illustrated, there were RCA Institutes and National Radio Institute is the one I'm talking about. And CREI, I think it's called, another organization. There were many organizations that were giving courses. I think they still do, some of them anyway. Some of them are out of business. Anyway, so this particular National Radio Institute book is called RF Transmission Lines, Filters, and Couplers. So I decided to dive into this book instead, because this book will give an overview of what a transmission line is as far as the various types: open wire, ladder line, coax, waveguide, and so on. So I would talk about this. I would talk from this book instead, if everybody would be interested, and hopefully everybody is, to give a discussion on transmission lines first, before we go into how to use them to match. Okay, so logically speaking, you gotta, you know, do one thing before the other so you get a good foundation. All right, let me let it drop. Any questions so far? Any questions? WA2CDO. Okay, I know people are dying to hear what a transmission line is. So here we go. I'm going to just start reading from this book. And there's a number of pages here. And I'm not going to read the whole thing. I'm going to divide this into a number of weeks because there's quite a bit of information. And so I'm going to do this before we get into the actual impedance matching part of it. So here we go. See, transmission lines serve as closed-circuit, non-radiating links between various sections of a radio system. By the way, I'm reading this word for word, but of course I'll add my own words. Transmission lines are used to feed power from transmitters to their antenna systems and to carry energy between the various stages of a transmitter. The links between receiving antennas and receivers are also transmission lines. Okay, so that's basically what they do. And so now we're going to study transmission lines and find out how they work. Okay, so here is the main issue, or the main part, I should say, of transmission lines in this book here. Okay, so again, as I just said, the purpose of a transmission line is to transfer signal power from the signal source to the load with a minimum of signal attenuation. When the line is carrying power, such as between the transmitter output and the transmitting antenna, the signal radiation from the line should be as low as possible. Which, when you think about it, you don't want the signal to radiate away from the antenna. Otherwise, less power goes to the antenna and it's not going to be directed to the antenna. So, as we discussed in past weeks, and it says right here, maximum power will be transferred when the impedance at the input and output of the line match the line impedances. Impedance matching also prevents signal radiation. This is particularly important when the radio station must direct its radiated energy according to a specific pattern. And radio stations do that because nighttime propagation is different than daytime, so they either cut back their power or they change their direction pattern or what have you, and they do that deliberately. So, before we discuss the electrical characteristics of a transmission line, let us...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
All right, remind me guys about the timeout. I should put a timeout timer on this thing so I know when to unkey. But it doesn't have it. This radio doesn't have that. So, I will keep in mind to unkey. So before we discuss the electrical characteristics of a transmission line, let us briefly discuss the types of lines that are used. And there are a number of different types of lines. So, there are many types of transmission lines, as shown in, there's a couple of figures here, and unfortunately I can't show you the figures. But we have open wire lines. Okay, can everyone stand by? I have an important call coming in. Roy, back to you. Let me just take this.
With the presentation. Let me ask if anyone saw the YouTube video that I gave the link to, which was on Lenz's Law. And if so, do they see what might be the error of this guy's way?
AC2LR with a question on Andy's Perkins.
Okay, I have a question for Andy, but Andy's away for a little while taking a phone call.
I think most of you will probably know the answer to this. It's about transmission lines.
Oh.
Do transmission lines primarily have to be made of copper, or can they be made of anything you can kind of find laying around, like wires that you might have salvaged from a regular radio, a CD player and an FM radio, things like that.
Well, theoretically speaking, any decent conductor can be used as transmission line, depending upon, though, what the material is made of at the surface, because you have to keep in mind that most of the conduction on RF is taking place due to the skin effect. And we talked about this a few weeks ago, that the famous LMR 400 is actually copper-clad aluminum. Its core is aluminum, but it's wrapped in a layer of copper, and because the skin effect has most of the current going through the copper, resistance difference between copper and aluminum is not really anything. But theoretically, the copper is the best conductor. You can have anything as the core, I guess, especially with RF and skin effects. But a good conductor is better than a worse conductor. So aluminum isn't that great. The other problem with aluminum is, by itself, it's much more fragile, and so it breaks more easily than a piece of copper of the same width.
I'm back. WHCDO back.
Comment?
Yes, please, comment.
Copper is not the best conductor, but I understand where you're coming from. Silver is actually 7% more conductive than copper for the given length. KD2CXK, back to next.
WB2EAV with a quick comment.
Yes, 1 second, Ed. Craig, you are quite right, but I don't think anyone out there might have bought silver wire. The reason where silver is, if you ever go into the inductive coil of a very nicely designed antenna tuner, they are silver-coated simply because of that quality that silver has, better than even copper. But I agree with you, but in our world, maybe in other zip codes, people could afford silver wires. Here, copper is probably the best bang for the buck. Ed, you wanted to say something.
Yeah, when I was a teenager, there was still some surplus World War II radio equipment that could be adapted to be put on 2 meters. And that stuff had the most beautiful silver-plated air core coils. It only takes like a thousandth of an inch or so of plating to really give you the benefits of silver without going broke.
Yeah, I mean, that's the beauty of the skin effect. But I've read and talked to a few people who've told me that there is ways to screw up a silver plating method. You have to kind of know what you're doing. Just any generic silver plating sometimes causes more problems than it solves.
Comment?
Yes, Hank.
No, it's still Craig, KD2CXK. If you notice good quality connectors, like those from the military, made by Amphenol or Fairchild or other companies, are usually, almost always, even to this day, silver-plated.
Okay, like I said, silver is the best, but no one's going to buy silver wire that I know. Maybe I should just befriend those guys. But thanks. I'm sorry I misidentified you. Andy, now that you're back, do you want to continue?
AQ2LR with a question for Andy.
Okay, yes, I'm going to continue. We only scratched the surface. Is that Kay? Go ahead, Kay, AQ2LR.
My neighbor is a retired telephone worker, and he threw out a spool of telephone wire, and I grabbed it because I saw wire. And when I sliced it open, it's like a rubber wrapping around 7 smaller wires, colors of different colors. It looks like some of copper. Would I be able to use that as a transmission line?
I didn't get your whole question because you faded into the noise. Your signal's not that good. I don't think so offhand. So just repeat it again quickly because you were quite noisy.
Can I say something? I think I know what she's talking about.
Yes.
I have a better signal now.
That's noisy. Is it? It should be like 7 conductors, 22 gauge, solid wire, with all in one plastic outer cover.
Yes, I don't know what 22 gauge is. They're very skinny, but they are inside one all-encompassing gray cover sheet.
About like an automatic. Like an automatic pencil lead, those little leads that you press the button.
Say that again, we were overlapping.
You know those automatic pencils that you press the button to advance the lead, like one of those leads, that thickness?
Comment?
That kind of thickness, as like a pencil lead.
Comment? Go ahead.
82CXK. If it's telephone cable, it's probably 8 conductor. So just verify that. On the jacket of the cable, it may say something category 3, cat 3, cat 4, cat 5, very rare cat 4, cat 5, cat 5E, cat 6. Most telephone systems now are run on that cable. And it's 8 conductor, 22 gauge solid copper, not clad, it's solid copper, and they're 4 pairs, and each pair is twisted around each other, so you have white, orange, and orange twisted together, white, green, and green twisted together, white, blue, and blue twisted together, and white, brown, and brown twisted together. That's the most common kind of cable you might see, unless it's very ancient, KD2CXK back to net. And I have the comment on the transmission line.
I'd like to get back to my discussion.
This is your discussion.
All right, because I was talking about transmission lines, like getting a little bit off the track. I only have another little bit more than a half an hour left, so I've got a lot of material to cover. So I'd like to move forward with that. If that's okay, Roy?
Sure, this is your corner, Andy.
Okay, I just want to stick to transmission lines because I want to get into the types of transmission lines that we were just, you know, one want to discuss. And then we can talk about the other lines and telephone type lines, you know, later on. So thanks for the comments and questions on that. All right, keeping on track here. Okay, so there are many types of transmission lines, as I mentioned, and there are open wire lines, parallel wire lines, which are most common in high-frequency broadcast and high-frequency service. And, of course, coaxial lines, you've got waveguides and surface waveguides and so on. So, in regard to open wire lines, I'm going to mention that as far as the different types. Open wire lines, the parallel wire lines are referred to as balanced because the conductors have similar current and voltage relationships with respect to ground. So normally in an open wire line you're going to have that's known as a balanced line. And it is to an advantage of using an open wire line going connected to a dipole antenna because a dipole is basically a balanced antenna. And you can put that through a matching transformer. So, I'm looking at the figures here. We have different types of open wire lines. We have 2-wire, 4-wire. We have wires with spaces between. We have solid dielectric open wire lines. We have perforated dielectric, which is known as ladder lines because it looks like a ladder. And we also have shielded 2-wire lines. let me just see here. Parallel Okay, so depending on the construction, parallel lines can be air-spaced or contain a dielectric material between their wires, which is shown in these figures, which shows insulated spaces at suitable points along the line to maintain a constant spacing between the conductors of the open wire line. So we also have a continuous dielectric material between the conductors. This line can be made flexible and can be routed with less difficulty.
Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Okay, so move to CDL. Okay, got the beep. Alright, so the line we made flexible and can be routed with less difficulty than a more rigid open wire types. This type of transmission line, which is also called twin lead, which is what I mentioned before, is widely used in TV installations to feed the TV signal from the antenna to the receiver. Heavy-duty twin lead is also available for use in transmitting applications. So most people are familiar with twin lead. Maybe you're back to your youngin' days when you had a rabbit ears type of antenna connected to your TV set that was usually connected by a twin lead. And incidentally, twin leads are usually 300 ohms as far as their impedance is concerned. The ladder line that we talk about uses usually 450 ohms. Or you can go even to a higher impedance, the wider the spacing. The spacing affects the impedance. So sometimes the dielectric material is perforated, and that's another mechanical configuration. And that has the characteristics somewhere between those of an open wire and a solid dielectric type. So, and again, they're showing figures here. An open wire or parallel line type can be shielded by surrounding the two conductors with an outer shield. This line is referred to as a two-conductor shielded cable. So these are the basic configurations of open wire lines. Okay, so now we'll get into coaxial lines, which is what most people want to hear because everybody uses coax. Well, most people do anyway. All right, let me let it drop. Okay, so the lines shown in figures, the following figures are called unbalanced because the outer conductor is maintained at ground potential. Okay, notice that the lines shown in this particular figure, one conductor is placed inside the other. Lines of this type are called coaxial lines. And I'm sure that most people know what a coaxial cable looks like, from the center conductor to the outer conductor. We also abbreviate this as simply coax. So when you go to the store, you know, you want to order, you need some cable, you say, I want some coax. And that's what they'll give you. The inner conductor is called the hot or high side of the transmission line system. The outer conductor completely surrounds the inner conductor and thereby acts as an effective shield to confine the radio energy within itself. Remember I said, you know, coaxial lines should have minimum attenuation and also not radiate away from the line itself. To confine the signal inside the line. Thus, the coaxial type of line gives effective shielding to reduce stray pickup and spurious radiation, which is not possible with an open wire line. A coaxial line may also have air spacing with occasional dielectric spaces, but to obtain a more flexible line, a solid dielectric material is used in most coaxial systems. Depending on the quality of the line, and I've been a victim of this, we all have, there are different percentages of shielding. Excuse all the static, the repeater is making that noise. There are different percentages of shielding that's that's used depending on the quality of the coax cable that you buy. Let me let it drop. Okay, the air dielectric lines are often gas-filled to give more constant line characteristic and to prevent arcing between the inner conductor and the shield, and to also prevent moisture from accumulating within the line. I've used and worked with many years ago open air line that has a gas inserted, and it's like I just mentioned, it keeps the line constant and prevents arcing, especially if you're putting a higher voltage, a higher power, using more voltage but a higher power into the coax cable, and you don't want that to arc. So they put there's also a dehydrator that's used that removes any moisture from the line. And I know a company called Andrew, which is my name, makes that dehydrator. Usually these coaxial cables are considered to be hard lines because they can have a hollow center conductor. It's still a coax cable because there is a shield, and it's usually not a braided shield. It's usually a solid copper shield, and it can come as much as an inch, 2 inches, 3 inches, and even greater than that, as far as cable sizes are concerned. And they're pretty difficult to bend, and we don't use them as amateur radio operators. We don't really need a cable with that kind of characteristics and dimensions, but they are used in the industry. All right, any questions up to this point? WA2CDO. Okay, by the way, Ed, I guess you're listening. I guess you must have gotten your power back because you were on the air, which is good. Okay, so now I'll talk a little bit about waveguides and surface wave conductors. Radio energy, or radio frequency energy, rather, can also be sent in waveguides or over surface wave conductors, which is shown in the figures that I have here. The waveguide is an efficient method of conveying high frequency or ultra-high frequency and microwave energy. The dimensions of the waveguide are chosen according to the frequency of the energy to be carried by the guide. When the physical dimensions are correct, the energy is confined within the waveguide and can be transmitted along its length and guide with very little loss and attenuation. And I'm not going to go into waveguide discussions or the theory behind that. That's another topic. This is just an overview about using a waveguide, and that's why they're mentioning it. Let me let it drop. I don't want to keep saying let me let it drop. I'm just going to drop it. High-frequency waves can also be sent along a single conductor in the form of a surface wave. A very thin dielectric coating is placed on the single conductor line. External fields about this dielectric insulating material act as those associated with the coaxial conductor. In effect, the wave is confined to the surface of the conductor and is transported along the length with minimum radiation. Microstrip, I would consider to be like surface wave. And when I worked at AIL, we did some tuning on microstrips. It'll probably like this one. Using pieces of gold placed on the conductors that makes up the microstrip. And if I recall, alumina, I think it's what it's called, is the actual dielectric that the copper conductor is placed on. And it could be spiraled into a coil, a round coil. It could be lengthened. It could be shortened. It could zigzag and go all over the place, depending on the impedance and what kind of circuit you want to have the microstrip be on. So there's a lot, and that's a whole field in itself. but they call it surface wave conductors. So, Ed, let me just see if Ed, if you're there, I think you are. I think you're familiar with microstrip design. Is that right, Ed? Back to you.
Yes, I am. But usually, what it is there's a layer of this aluminum, which is really a ceramic, with a little strip running on the top, and the bottom of it is resting on a metallic ground.
Yeah, it's placed over a ground plane, which is the bottom part of it, just like you described. That's correct.
Yeah, I've seen those. And, yeah, they're usually very small stuff, very, very carefully done, very controlled dimensions, very precise impedances and all that.
Yeah, there's a lot of mathematics involved. I think it's Hammerstein. I'm probably not pronouncing it right. Is a set of formulas that are used to calculate the width of the conductor and the length of the conductor and the spacing between the conductors and so on. All the parameters of the microstrip. I think it's Hammerstein or Hammer something, and this goes way back, and I haven't worked with this in years, so I'm just going by memory. Okay, with that, let me continue. WA2CDL. You're listening to Andy's Corner. I'm going to let it drop. Okay, thanks, Ed, for your information on that. So the surface wave line has less power loss at high frequencies than the coaxial line, which is true, because surface wave, or what I call microstrip, is used in microwave frequencies and above. You do see them on some printed circuit boards, the normal printed circuit boards, and I forget the number of the circuit boards that are used at much lower frequencies, but not too often. Microstrip design is usually in the microwave region, much higher frequencies because the losses are a lot less. So it says here, horn-like outer shields are placed at the transmission line ends and at other points along the line to guide the surface wave properly. And there's a little picture of what that looks like. Okay, so that's basically you know, your waveguide and your surface wave and your open wire line. So now we're going to get into a little discussion of characteristics of transmission lines, and this is getting more now into the meat of what coaxial cable looks like electrically and how that works, how the wave propagates down the line, you know, which is an interesting phenomena, how it works, how this does it. So, let me let it drop. Okay. All transmission lines, no matter how long they may be, have certain basic characteristics which must be considered. We will consider a two-conductor transmission line. However, the following applies equally to coaxial lines. So, this will be put into coax cable, which of course we use. Firstly, remember that any piece of wire, no matter how short it is, has both inductance and resistance. It is true that a short wire has a very low inductance and a low resistance, but regardless of how low they may be, they cannot be ignored. Thus, even in a very short piece of two-wire transmission line, there's a picture of it, we find we have an inductive and a resistance. We have inductance and resistance as shown in the figure. And what I can convey here is, if you visualize a piece of wire having a series inductor, so you draw a coil, and then connected to the coil in series is a resistor. And that makes up that inductance of the line, no matter how short it is, and the resistance of the line, because every wire has a certain amount of resistance. Now, again, if we consider the two wires in our transmission line, we must remember that we have two pieces of metal separated by a dielectric. Let me just go back 1 second to make sure I didn't forget anything. Okay. So, I said it right. Again, if we consider the two wires, because this is going to be a two-wire line we're talking about, the two wires in our transmission line, we must remember that we have two pieces of metal separated by a dielectric. Thus, we have capacity between the two conductors that must also be considered. So now, you could visualize a capacitor going across that network, you know, that inductor and that resistor that I just mentioned. You put a capacitor across it because you're dealing with a parallel, two-wire parallel line. You have capacitance between it. Same thing with coax cable, by the way. There's no difference. That's what I said in the beginning. You can visualize that. It's a little bit easier with a two-wire conductor to see it rather than looking at a circular cable, which is or circular configuration, which is a piece of coax.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Okay, I didn't miss anything. WHCDL, and let it drop. Station.
Yeah, Andy, clear up something for me, please. KD2NSJ. What is all this in reference to? Is this like coax in your house wiring? Or where does it go to?
If you have a piece of cable going to your TV, your coax cable going to your cable box, that's the coax I'm talking about. That's the characteristics of it.
Okay, got you now. Go ahead. Thank you.
Yeah, we use coax all the time, but we don't think of it. We just use it. Most people have TVs in their homes, and they have to get the signal to the cable box somehow. From the fiber optic box that comes into the house, and then it's transferred to cable, and your cable is your coax cable. So, and that's what this is about. So as I just mentioned, the capacity between the conductors, this capacity, even though it may be small, exists regardless of how short we make the line. You also know from your studies, past studies of capacitors, that there was no such thing as a perfect capacitor. There will always be some leakage. This leakage we represent by a resistance in parallel with the capacitance, so that when we add the resistance and capacitance across the line, the equivalent circuit of a short length of line looks like the figure that I'm looking at now. Which again, if you want to visualize it, this is the electrical equivalent of a piece of coax cable. You got a series inductor and a series capacitor with a capacitor across the line, which is the dielectric, the capacitance of the dielectric in a coax cable, and you have resistance across it because there's no perfect capacitor. So this network, it's actually called a lumped source or a lumped constant. And this continuously throughout the length of the line. Let me let it drop. So for convenience, in drawing the schematic of the transmission line, we have represented the inductance and resistance in series of the line as though they were separate from each other and in series with each other. We have also represented the capacitance and resistance across the line as being connected across the line in one place. And we refer to these as lumped constants. So, you know, for simplicity, you have to draw it out somehow to visualize what's going on inside a piece of coax cable. You know, we're going to get into the discussion of how the signal propagates through this, you know, lumped constant. And we're going to get into that. I have about 15 minutes left, but we'll continue this next week because there's a lot to discuss. So again, ladies and gentlemen out there, it's an overview of what you guys work with every day as being ham radio operators. So again, this is just a basic discussion of what we use and how it works, and that's what this whole thing is about. So I'm going to let it drop. This is WHCDO. As far as these lumped constants are concerned, that's my own words, actually they are spread out over the entire length of the line rather than lumped into one location. However, we treat the line as though it were made of these lumped constants. Indeed, it would be very difficult to try to show the line schematic any other way. You really can't show it any other way schematically as a lumped constant. But that's basically the electrical equivalent of a coax cable. Okay, so any questions in regard to that so far? WA2CDM.
WA2DDH with a comment.
Okay, I hear the static on YouTube, by the way. We're going to see if we can fix that. Now, go ahead, I think it's John.
Yeah, fine business, yeah. Just one comment wanted to make about microstrip. A microstrip or strip line, I don't think that's a surface wave propagation. I think surface wave, you're talking about like a single conductor as a surface wave. A microstrip is basically TEM. Anything that propagates down to DC where you have two conductors is going to be TEM. A surface wave is like a single conductor, like a Gabbro line or G line. That's a surface wave type propagation. Go ahead.
Yeah, TEM. What is this? Is that transverse electric as far as what I remember for TEM?
Transverse electromagnetic.
TEM, transverse electromagnetic mode with TEM, TEM modes. If you go further than that.
Okay, very good. Yep, and I stand to be corrected on that, you're right. I was thinking of a single conductor microstrip line, rather that's got the TEM characteristic that surface lines don't have, so you're right. Okay, John, thank you. Okay, anybody else with any questions before we continue? Okay. So, let me just get my notes here. So we have a schematic representation of a complete line, hopefully visualizing it in the back of our heads, minds, whatever. And if you do that, you can see that it's spread out along the line. And here it says, notice that it's simply made up of a number of sections like the one shown. We have shown a generator is connected to one end of the line, which is the transmitter, and supply power to it, and the load resistance connected to the opposite end, and the resistive and reactive values depend on the line construction and such physical characteristics as the conductor size and spacing and the type of dielectric used. So again, all that I'm just mentioning will convert to the impedance of the line, because coaxial lines have different impedances. So the fact that a transmission line is made up of resistive and reactive components means that the line must offer an impedance, which I just said, to any signal that it carries. This impedance is called the characteristic impedance or surge impedance. So in electrical terms, or in engineering terms, I should say, It's called the characteristic impedance. And that's what they call it. We don't call it that, but they do. So characteristic impedance depends on the physical construction of the transmission line and hence will be different for different types of lines. Okay. I think I'm going to end it here. It is getting late. The next discussion will take about a half an hour. It's going to be, and this is important. So, ladies and gentlemen, this is important to know. This is going to be a discussion of how the wave propagates along the transmission line. So how does the signal propagate through these lump constants that I just was speaking about? So I tell you what, at this point, I know we started late, and we had some good discussions before I came on. So I'll end it now. I usually end around this time anyway. And we'll continue next week, and the week after, and the week after that. So stay tuned, because there's a lot more to learn. And I think it's a good discussion for anyone to have a refresher course about transmission lines and how your power gets from your transmitter to your antenna.
Okay. Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Okay, timeout was perfect on that one. Okay, so with that, thank you for letting me talk, and thank you for listening, whoever's left. Most people probably fell asleep. Roy, back to you, and we'll be back on the quarter next week. AC2GS, W8CDO.
Question to Andy.
Okay, question.
When we were talking about basic four types of transmission line, which would be two-wire parallel transmission line, coaxial cable, strip type, sub, straight transmission lines, and waveguides, are you going to discuss all of them?
Yeah, later on down, I gotta look at this. Yeah, we will get into some discussion on, I'm trying to keep this to coaxial cable because that's what we're most familiar with. I don't think most of the people here are using waveguides or anything like that. But they have there were some similarities, and we're gonna be getting into standing waves. How a standing wave is formed on the line too. So you know, that's something that people would be interested in. Okay. All right. Does that answer?
Uncle Juice, so you're saying you're going to bypass, you're going to put aside strip types of straight transmission lines and waveguides and parallel transmission lines, you're going to discuss only coaxial lines?
Yes, for now, yes. Later on, I have other books on that subject. But for now, we're going to stick to... The whole purpose of this, Wes, keep in mind, this has to do with impedance matching, okay? The whole discussion is about impedance matching. Don't lose track of that. Keep that in the back of your head, because I'm trying to convey the information of how a coaxial cable or transmission line, how it works, before we go into how we use that different lengths to match impedances, okay? So I'm trying to get the basics down first. Don't jump too far ahead.
No, I'm not trying to jump too far ahead. It's just that resistance and inductance together are called transmission line impedance. And capacitance and conductance together are called admittance. Are we going to be discussing impedance and admittance?
Not right now.
I'm sorry, pushing so much. But the impedance is a resistance and inductance together. So you say not now, right now. So right now is impedance, which would be the main subject of the discussion, or right not right now admittance, or right now what?
I think Andy's trying to avoid getting bogged down in complex math.
Well, that's one thing that's obvious. We're not going to get into the math, but again, you know, I want to convey how a coax cable works so people can understand that. Okay, with that, I got to go. See you next week, guys. Roy, back to you, W82CDO.
AC2GS, thank you very much, Andy. That was another edition of Andy's Corner, and I'm looking forward to next Sunday's episode of the next Andy's Corner. You have to understand that the subjects that Andy takes on are so broad-based that he could go on for 500 or 600 hours. You could make a college course based on some of the subjects that he picks up. So these are primarily overviews on the subject. He might revisit them with certain focus at some point down the road, but you have to understand that, you know, some people are just starting out with most of this theory. If you dive in deep, you're going to lose all of them. So thank you very much, Andy.
Roy, I have to disagree with you.
And I have to disagree with you.
Okay, you're all free to disagree with me. Ed, would you like to kind of widen out your disagreement with me?
Yeah, very simple. You said a college course. How about an entire master's degree program?
Okay, I will agree with you, and probably even a smaller subset of the subject. As you go up the academic credential ladder, it becomes more and more about lesser aspects of a subject. So, yeah, you could probably make a few thousand PhD theses based on little teeny bits and pieces of this underlying theory.
Okay. And the thing that I disagree with is the transmission line is being discussed. We're not talking about going deep. We're talking about a main parameter of transmission line, which would be impedance, admittance, in effect, ductance, conductance, characteristic impedance, right, impedance matching, reflection coefficients, and what else? The sending wave ratio, VSWR, and losses due to the impedance match. We might also touch the voltage regulation, but that is not essential. It's a stupid matching as well. Now, saying two phrases or three phrases about each one, just for the audience to know what it is about, is not too much pain, is it?
All I can tell you, Wesley, is anyone who presents any instructional material has to decide on their own syllabus and whether they want to touch lightly on 100 different topics or they just want to touch on 5 or 10. So, you know, it's up to the individual. When you're presenting a topic, you factor in the syllabus and the points that you want to make, and some people would probably want it broader and others would want it more narrow. You can't please everyone. So everyone who decides to make the effort, like Andy has, can set the syllabus to whatever he wants it to be.
VDH with a quick comment.
Certainly, John.
Yeah, I just want to take the time to congratulate Andy. I think he's doing a good job. He's taking a vast subject and giving just the essentials. And believe me, it's not easy to give off the most important points and present it in a way that you know, doesn't get too complicated, but still conveys the important points. And to talk about things like reflection coefficient, well, as Andy said, the next thing he's going to talk about is how the wave propagates. You have to talk about the propagation on a cable before you can start talking about reflection. So I think Andy's doing a fine job, and I think he's got a nice syllabus laid out. Probably has it diagrammed out to exactly what he's going to present. So congratulations to him.
I do agree with that. Great job. The only thing is that somebody said about TM, transverse electromagnetic. No, it's not transverse electromagnetic, it's transverse electric mode. and that what is happening in coaxial cable. But anyhow, it's a great subject. Some people might be just satisfied of listening to what Andy says, and some people just want to go deeper. I wanted to set the boundaries, find out what is the depth of the subject discussed. This way, I wouldn't really upset the subject by going deeper into it.
Wait a minute. It's TETM and TEM mode. So it's transverse electric mode, transverse magnetic mode, and transverse electromagnetic mode.
I'm confused. Transverse electric mode, transverse magnetic mode, transverse electric, TM. Shit. Maybe you're right. Dr. Roy.
Well, Ed, thanks, Ed. Yeah, I agree with Ed's interpretation of those different modes. I agree with everyone. I think Andy is doing a great job, and I look forward to next week. Again, he's picking these very broad subjects, and there's a lot of material that you could cover that would take up way more time than anyone would listen continuously. So you have to pick and choose, and that's the responsibility of presenting the information, and Andy's doing a great job, and I look forward to it in the future.
Lenslaw.
Say again?
About your video on Lenslaw.
Didn't quite make that out. Something about a video. Are you alluding to the YouTube video that I posted?
Yes, sir.
Okay, would you like to comment on what this guy apparently got wrong?
No, I'd like to hear what you have to say.
Okay, I was hoping that we could have a kind of give and take from someone who either can see the problem with the experimental method and we can talk back and forth. But you know, if anyone else out there wants to kind of play this little game, otherwise I'll do it by myself. What happened was I posted a YouTube on my link page. It's a gentleman who was curious about the lens law. You probably have seen it someplace, somewhere. Person puts a neodymium, a high strength magnet through a copper pipe, and it slows down its descent due to lens law breaking. And he decides that he would very much like to see what happens if he takes a carbon rod and drills it out to the same diameters to see if it demonstrates the same breaking phenomena of the copper pipe or a different one. And he finds the results. He tests using a volt ohmmeter for resistance, and he conducts his experiment and then wonders why the results are the way it is. So anyone out there who saw it and would like to comment on it first before I give it all away? One more time. Someone kind of triggered the repeater but didn't have any audio. Okay, we'll give it one last try, and then I'll just tell you the story and be done with it. Anyone who saw the video or who is familiar with lens law and has seen those neodymium magnets kind of slow down as they drop through the center of a copper pipe can probably guess what would happen if you use a carbon pipe instead of the copper. But if you've seen it or you think you understand the concept and you want to discuss it, please give me your call sign.
Roy, may I make an alternate proposal?
Certainly, Ed.
Somebody had a question that kind of got cut off. Maybe we should address that first if she's still there.
Okay, I did not notice that there was a question out there. If someone has a question, please give it to us.
So when Andy had his phone call, there was a question about some scavenged wire.
Oh, okay. I don't know if Kay's still around. If Kay's still around and you want to discuss this, please.